Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we've got a lot of important stuff to talk about. I think you'll find the stories quite fascinating. I want to start off with the debate over the upcoming quadrennial Boy Scout Jamboree, which generated a lot of controversy because they've got a beautiful new site in the West Virginia mountains with all kinds of wilderness challenges, but there's going to be one big omission: scouts who are dangerously overweight. This is the most physically demanding wilderness gathering of the Boy Scouts since the first Jamboree, which is a camp out held around the Washington Monument in 1937. And this is a new thing, and it's kicking up quite a lot of ruckus. To be eligible for this year's mass gathering, the tens of thousands of scouts, and their leaders as well, had to meet standards for body mass index and other health factors. Scouts whose BMI was 40 or above were banned from the Jamboree. Those who were intermediate, considered overweight but not extremely obese, they had to submit medical information to be approved. Their BMIs were 32 to 39.9. So let's give you a little bit of an example of what that might be. A kid might be, you know, Boy Scout might be 5'4", not fully grown. Maybe that's the average height of a Boy Scout, 5'4". So at 200 pounds, that boy would have a BMI of 34.3. That would put him in the range where they would have to get a special note, doctor's note, saying that they were qualified for physical activity. But there's a cutoff point, 40 or above, where they said, no way, no how can you participate. So taking the same example of a 5'4" boy at 240 pounds, now that would be a pretty obese kid, right? Short and a lot of weight. The BMI would be 41, which is grossly obese, and that would disqualify a kid. But to show you the limitations of the BMI has been much criticized because it's a mathematical formula. You can go on the internet and there are BMI calculators. You can actually find lots of these on the web, and you plug in your height and your weight, and it comes up with a formula that gives you your body mass index. And say a kid was 5'4", but 150 pounds. Now, a kid who doesn't have a lot of muscles, who's 5'4", weighs 150 pounds, that'd be a little bit of a chubby kid. But there are some 5'4" kids who are very strong and muscular, and maybe a little bit broad-shouldered already at a young age. So 150 pounds, that's not very heavy. That's, you know, it's less than what I weigh at 5'10". 5'4", 150 pounds, the BMI would be 26. That would be defined as overweight, because up to 25 is considered normal weight. And true obesity defined as 30 and above, but overweight is 25 and above. So here's another example. Say you're talking a kid who's playing football already, and he's a big kid, big, strong kid, 6'1", 200 pounds. And, you know, there are kids like that. You know, even at the age of 15, 16, you're going to see kids who are tall and already manly, broad-shouldered, 200 pounds. That's not that heavy. I mean, the average running back in the NFL might be 6'1 or 6'2 and weigh 230, 240 pounds. Tight end or something like that. By the criterion of the BMI, that's considered overweight. So, you know, that is not, you know, there's some limitations to the BMI. If you are athletic and muscular, that's going to overestimate your weight. If you're at the other end of the extreme, if you're older and flabby, you know, maybe you're carrying a big pot belly, but you don't have any muscles, it will show that you're normal weight. So this it may actually obscure your potential for being metabolically overweight. So this has come. This whole BMI restriction has come under a firestorm of criticism. Scouts were required to have a physical exam before the annual fitness competition in West Virginia. So that's a non-discriminatory policy. They just, overall, the kids have to have a certificate from their doctor saying they're fit enough to participate in these arduous activities, including kayaking, rock climbing, bouldering, skateboarding, mountain biking, BMX riding, gliding. There's a 3-mile uphill hike and a 3,000-foot-long zip line. So, you know, Boy Scouts have to protect themselves from liability. They don't want any kids to conk out. It's summer. The temperatures are high. I get it. But critics have said that this is exclusionary. They quote here in an article, Patricia Bannon, a registered dietitian and author of Eat Right When Time is Tight. Haven't heard of that book, but catchy title. Said the ban is meant to protect scouts who become ill during the 10-day competition. But the boy shouldn't be banned. She's quoted as saying, unfortunately, it still does exclude children due to their weight. I'm sure that they're looking at their health and potential negative health consequences, but maybe they could walk the course or do what they can and not be excluded. Anything that the Boy Scouts could do to compensate for the stigma of being excluded would be great. An advocacy group for overweight individuals called the Council on Size and Weight Discrimination said the policy was, quote, unfair and discriminatory. The group said in their statement, quote, there are Boy Scouts who are heavier than average but extremely fit and capable of strenuous physical activity. At the same time, it's patently absurd to assume that just because a boy is thin, that means he's capable of a 3-mile hike up a mountain. And so the battle lines are drawn. And, you know, really, it's interesting because you can look at it from two standpoints. One is, it's good that the boy scouts maintain standards for optimal weight, because a kid who may be interested in participating in these activities, who's overweight, would be incentivized to embark on a weight loss program, eating more healthy and exercising, just to get to the jamboree. That would be great. On the other hand, a lot of people are genetically prone to be overweight, and try as they might, their metabolisms are very bulky, and it's very hard for them to lose weight. So already, I would say that overweight people are more stigmatized than any other group in this country. I mean, say what you will. I mean, Trayvon Martin, notwithstanding racism, you know, religious discrimination, etc., discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, well, those are biggies. But almost uniformly, Americans who are overweight are disdained by their more svelte peers. And any policy that discriminates against overweight individuals or stigmatizes them might further marginalize them and make it less likely that they're going to make efforts to improve their lot. And I think it's a tough call. Should the Boy Scouts exclude individuals who are very overweight? There are arguments both pro and con. Here's an interesting sidelight, because automatically it's assumed that if you're fat, you're not fit, right? And by the way, the American Medical Association has just declared obesity a disease akin to cancer, AIDS, cardiovascular disease, psychosis. All these are bona fide diseases. And so is now overweight. But studies show that people can be fat and fit. According to a study that came out last year, international study of 43,265 people shows that people can be obese but metabolically healthy and fit. and they have as much chance of keeping cardiovascular disease and cancer at bay as normal weight people. And so that's interesting. I mean, look, no question that individuals who are thinner are less likely to get cardiovascular disease, but 46% of obese individuals in this recent study were found to be, quote, metabolically healthy. Now, they were, you know, say take two people who are 5'10", and they weigh, let's say, 250 pounds. But, you know, pretty much you could agree that's overweight. One group of individuals might have a much higher risk of heart disease or cancer, or diabetes, certainly. And the other group might have almost no risk. It turns out that among the obese recruits who are metabolically healthy, they had a 38% lower risk of death from any cause than their metabolically unhealthy obese peers. And that's the same risk as healthy, normal weight participants. The risk of developing or dying from heart disease or cancer was reduced by between 30 to 50% for metabolically healthy obese people compared with fat unhealthy people. Now, what's the difference? How do you know you're overweight, you look sort of like another overweight individual? How do you know that you're metabolically fit or that you're not metabolically fit? Well, blood tests will reveal that. You may have some individuals who are overweight have very, very out of kilter cholesterol to HDL ratio, high levels of triglycerides. Their blood sugar may be elevated. For me, the big discriminator, the most useful test of all, is a glucose tolerance test with insulin. High levels of insulin are predictive of metabolic impairment. And I have seen some people really surprise me. They look for all the world like fatties. But when we do the glucose tolerance test, it's totally normal, and their insulin is within normal range. And the big difference, in my opinion, is exercise. Exercise sometimes doesn't make you shed all the pounds you want. And for some individuals who are overweight, they say, well, that's discouraging. I'm not even going to bother, because if I can't lose the weight, why bother to, you know, sweat, huff and puff, you know, have to take a shower and reset my hair. A lot of women, that's a disincentive, particularly. But it turns out that exercise, while it doesn't make necessarily the pounds melt off, it can make you metabolically fit, even if you're, shall we say, chunky, or maybe you might prefer the word zaftig, popular word here in New York region. So, you know, how are the Boy Scouts to say that a young individual who's got a BMI that suggests that they're morbidly obese is actually an unfit individual, incapable of carrying out the activities, the challenging activities at the jamboree? I think it's a bummer, I think, for some overweight kids who might really enjoy a lot of advantages if they get mainstreamed and if they got to participate in activities side by side with their less heavy peers. Here's the second study. We looked at data from 64,000 heart patients in Sweden. And they talk about something called the obesity paradox. And the obesity paradox is as follows. Fat patients who have heart disease paradoxically have better outcomes and survival than thinner patients. What's fascinating is, say you are, I mean, look, if you're thin, you're less likely to get heart disease. But if you do get heart disease, it is likely that that heart disease may be more dangerous and life-threatening than an individual who is overweight. So, you know, the relationship between overweight and risk of disease is not always one-to-one or clear-cut. You know, and I know what the Boy Scouts are trying to do. They're trying to say, look, we've got standards. We're an organization that promotes fitness, health, well-being, and we don't want to have tragedies at our jamboree. And we don't want to, you know, we want to make it, you know, challenging activity. You know, not just a bunch of boys sitting around getting merit badges by playing around with their iPads or learning how to do embroidery, right? You've got to do challenging physical activities. But there is an element in this policy of discrimination against a very important subgroup of our population. Okay, an important question for exercisers. How much protein is right for athletes? You know, we see, especially the kids, buying these big vats of protein powder. The vats are huge, and you could get big muscles just curling one of the vats. You know, they're so big and heavy. They're not petite. They're massive. And often on the labels, there are depictions of guys with massive pectoral muscles and massive biceps and triceps bursting out of their muscle shirts. And these formulas, the implication is that if you take more protein, your muscles are going to explode, just like on the pictures. And it's really different when I grew up. When I grew up, weightlifting wasn't that popular. I mean, there were, you know, the comic books that showed the 97-pound weakling getting sand kicked into his face by the bully at the beach and then urging that you buy a set of barbells or some primitive home exercise equipment so that you can build your muscles up. And then next time the bully, teases you at the beach, you can then smack the bully around, impressing your girlfriend. That, however, was a bit of a subculture when I was growing up in the 1960s. And nowadays, I think the vast majority of young men are concerned about their muscles. And they're very, very into weightlifting and bodybuilding. I mean, I see some of these young guys, and they are massive. I was a bit of a bookworm. I didn't really get into exercise until after college. Maybe I missed out. But you also see a tremendous amount of use of anabolic steroids among some of these younger kids. It's more and more part of our culture. You could refer to it as the male equivalents of anorexia, which is so common in females seeking an ultra-thin body image. You could call it a bigorexia, which is an effort by young men. You know, look, boys tend to be on the skinny side. It's only in their 20s that they start to get broad shoulders. And they shoot up like a string bean, and they're skinny. And then they start to broaden out when they reach a certain age. Now they're questing for that ideal male masculine body image using these types of protein powders and various types of sports aids. So the question is, how much do you need? And it comes to us via a study that looks at vegetarian athletes. Being a vegetarian, being an athlete, it can be problematic because it's sometimes hard to get a balance of the proper nutrients. Nevertheless, research has shown that vegetarian athletes have been present throughout history. In fact, analysis of the bones of Roman gladiators indicate that they may have been vegetarians. Why? Did they choose to be vegetarians? No. They were slaves. They were given a simple gruel. That was the origin of remember Roman meal bread? You know, they just got some simple gruel with some vegetables and some grains in there. And it was cheap peasant food. Meat and animal protein, more expensive and rarer. And these were slaves on the low end of the economic totem pole. So that's what they got to eat. And also, in modern days, there are several notable vegetarian athletes, such as marathon runners Bart Yasso and Scott Jurek, and pro Ironman triathlete Brendan Brazier. So it can work. I mean, these guys are high-performance athletes, and they don't seem to be slowed down by their vegetarian lifestyle. However, the research shows that vegetarians have to be careful because they must meet their dietary needs from exclusively plant-based sources, and that can be tricky. So what they need to find are non-meat sources of iron, which is tough because the best form of iron is from heme. Some of the most bioavailable form of iron is from dark meat poultry and red meat and darker species of fish and eggs. And of course you can get some iron from green leafy vegetables, but it's less bioavailable. And this is particularly a problem for vegetarian women because women have double trouble when it comes to iron. First of all, they menstruate. And secondly, athletic exertion tends to deplete iron. Whether you're male or female, for some reason, it tends to deplete iron. And they actually sometimes attribute this to microtrauma of the muscles and perhaps even some mild bleeding into the urinary tract. And that actually results in lower levels of iron in very heavy-duty exercise. I'm not talking about, you know, just, you know, jogging around the block. I'm talking about people who do very intense training, long-distance runners and triathletes and so on. So that may limit endurance performance, the iron deficiency, because iron is what gives you hemoglobin, and hemoglobin is what carries oxygen to your tissue. So you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage if you're an athlete who is low in iron, because you might get less efficient oxygen delivery to your hard-working muscles. So that might warrant using an iron supplement. And if you're really a dedicated vegetarian and your iron is low, taking an iron supplement might make sense. Vegetarians as a group also have lower mean muscle creatine concentrations. Creatine generally comes from animal sources, and creatine is essential for muscle function. It's actually something that bodybuilders take so that their muscles appear bigger. And there's some studies that suggest that creatine may improve muscle strength. Zinc tends to be low in vegetarian diets. Also, diets that are really high in grains contain phytate, which pulls zinc out of the system. B12, you can't get B12 in most animal foods. There's some fermented foods, however, which provide a little bit of B12. For example, in a macrobiotic diet, it turns out that you can get a little bit of B12 from foods like tempeh, which rely on fermentation with a certain species of mold that knits together the soybeans in tempeh. But vitamin D deficiency can make you very tired. And so perhaps taking a B12 supplement would be important if you're a vegan vegetarian. Vitamin D might be lower in a vegetarian diet, and calcium. And actually there's some studies that show that in exercise, you'd think you actually would improve your bone density, but long-distance cyclists, for example, have a problem with osteoporosis. There's a tendency for them to develop thinning of the bones. They're actually in a sitting position on the bike, and yes, they're putting a lot of pressure on their long bones in their legs. Nonetheless, they tend to get osteoporosis, particularly of the spine. And for those types of athletes, the timing of the vitamin D and calcium can be important. It actually appears that by taking vitamin D and calcium an hour or so prior to a bout of exercise is more advantageous than taking it afterwards. So, you can get adequate protein from a vegetarian diet, just harder. You have to eat more food. The protein is less dense, and protein quality may be less efficient. By, you know, for example, the protein spectrum of, there's protein in grains and there's protein in beans, and by combining, say, rice and beans, you may get a more complete protein. protein, but individually these are incomplete proteins. The most complete protein, of course, comes from eggs. Eggs are a very complete source of protein, but some vegetarians don't consume eggs. So what happens? What happens? Let's go back to the original principle. What happens when you take vats and vats and vats of protein? Does the protein improve your performance, and B, does it immediately spring into your muscles and make your muscles expand like the pictures on the vats of protein powder? And the answer is no. It turns out that athletes require 1 to 2 grams of protein per kilo of body weight. That's about a gram per pound. So ideally, a bodybuilder should seek to eat that amount in corresponding to their weight. So say that, it's a 200-pound bodybuilder, 200 grams of protein would be desirable and optimal for them to achieve their full muscle-building potential. Would be the goal. But let's say, say you want to go beyond that. Actually, studies now show that the benefits did not exist past the limit of 2.4 grams per kilo. So a kilo, say if you're a 100-kilo individual, is 220 pounds. So you say 240 grams would be the upper limits of optimal protein intake for somebody weighing 220 pounds. So if you're a woman who weighs half that much, you don't need 240 grams of protein. You don't need more than 120 grams of protein because it's just not going to go anywhere. According to a guy interviewed for this story, this is important because it seems to indicate there's an upper cap of protein intake that seems to promote protein synthesis to the maximum level. And if you exceed this upper cap of protein level intake, you will not be pushing protein synthesis any further. In fact, you're going to be oxidizing protein for energy production. So actually, protein can be used as a fuel. It's kind of an expensive fuel metabolically, less efficient than fat or carbohydrates, but it can be used by the body for energy production. But basically what they're saying here is if you get adequate carbohydrates and fat, you don't need to burn down your protein or oxidize it for energy production. So more than a gram or so per pound is going to be kind of a waste of time and money for somebody who is trying to achieve optimal muscle development. So, probably know from listening to me, I am not the biggest advocate of a vegetarian or vegan lifestyle. I think that it is a little less corresponding to humans' biological evolution, because humans in Paleolithic times consumed ample amounts of animal protein. However, some people seem to thrive on vegetarian diets. Metabolically, that may be suitable for them, or they may have very, very closely held moral beliefs about eating food from animal sources, and I respect that. But if you're going to be an athlete, you have to be careful because you can become deficient in certain nutrients if you don't plan your diet very scrupulously. Okay, there are many risk factors for osteoporosis. Some of it's genetic. It appears that some people are more genetically prone to osteoporosis. Sometimes you can ascertain this through family history. You ask a woman, did your mom or your grandma have osteoporosis? Do you have any sisters who have osteoporosis or have experienced a bone fracture? Clearly, there's some genetics involved there. In fact, they're beginning to explore some of the gene combinations that sets you up for poor bone formation and poor bone retention. Then, of course, there's nutrient factors, vitamin D and calcium and magnesium and many other nutrients that make up bone. Physical activity is a risk factor, too. You can do too little physical activity and get osteoporosis, but if you do excessive physical activity, you may also be prone to osteoporosis. This is shown in certain endurance athletes, particularly cyclists and swimmers who might turn out to be osteoporotic. For women, over-exercise causing a cessation of periods, that can actually make you more prone to osteoporosis. And on it goes. There are medications, of course, that can increase the risk of osteoporosis. Early menopause in men, loss of testosterone can promote osteoporosis. There are many questions that we ask when we're evaluating a person for the risk of bone loss and bone fracture. But here's a new one. This is a brand new one, and it's kind of cool because it's something that we test for at the Hoffman Center, and complementary physicians like myself are very attuned to this problem. It's insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. And so much in medicine can be traced to the metabolic syndrome. The definition, excess production of insulin, where the body actually resists the effects of insulin, called insulin resistance. This is associated with a higher risk for diabetes. You don't actually have to have diabetes. We see a lot of patients who don't have diabetes. According to the formal definition, they may be headed for non-insulin-dependent diabetes, but they don't yet have it, but they have insulin resistance. How do we detect this? Well, some of the clues are if you've got a big belly, if you have an increased waist-to-hip ratio, if you have high triglycerides, if you have an adverse cholesterol-to-HDL ratio, these suggest that you might be at risk of metabolic syndrome. If you have small particles on the what's called the VAPS test or a fractionation of your LDL, the small dangerous particles are associated with insulin resistance. There are a variety of ways. Look, my favorite way is to simply do a glucose tolerance test over a period of 4 or 5 hours. Measure the glucose, which might be normal or it might be abnormal. But the key is to measure the insulin. And if the insulin is substantially elevated, either when fasting or in response to a sugar challenge, bingo, you got the diagnosis of insulin resistance. All right, coming back to osteoporosis, this is fascinating. Insulin resistance linked to weaker bones. That's the conclusion of a study presented last week at the Endocrine Society's 95th annual meeting in San Francisco. By the way, the incidence of diabetes is quickly rising. Between the years of 1980 and 2011, get this statistic should really be alarming to you. The number of cases of diabetes jumped from about 6 million to nearly 21 million. Okay, so the researchers in this study, looking at the relationship between insulin resistance to bone strength, they found that bone strength decreased by 10 to 14% every time insulin resistance doubled. So the conclusion is that there's a lot of things that you can combat when you address insulin resistance. You need to address it with a lower carbohydrate diet, with more in the way of exercise. You can take nutrients like chromium, magnesium, omega-3 fatty acids. There are a whole variety of nutrients in good diabetes formulas. One that I'm particularly intrigued with these days is berberine. Berberine is an herb found in golden seal and Oregon grape root, and it seems to really address the problem of insulin resistance. It's available in a supplement that I use called CM Core. It's like, Charlie, Mary, CM Core. And it's available from drhoffman.com. It's one of my favorite supplements. It's actually been shown to be equivalent to the drug metformin in terms of its effectiveness at dealing with insulin resistance and elevated blood sugar in mild type 2 diabetes. That's fascinating because it's an herbal agent and it actually goes toe-to-toe with a pretty effective diabetes drug. But this is a condition that I love to treat. I think we in the field of complementary and alternative medicine are ideally situated to address the epidemic of insulin resistance in this country. So when you fix that, you're more energetic, you feel better, you're less likely to suffer from lethargy and depression. You look better because you have a smaller belly and better fat distribution. You lower your risk of diabetes, and hence you lower risk of cardiovascular disease. Hypertension often melts away, and you lower your risk of cancer and many inflammatory disorders. But lo and behold, you also lower your risk of osteoporosis. So fascinating new study from the Endocrine Society's 95th annual meeting in San Francisco. Insulin resistance can make your bones weaker. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us for this edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Please keep listening. Go to our website at drhoffman.com or subscribe to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast via iTunes.